Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Fueling Forward podcast. I'm your host, Maddie Alm, registered dietitian and former professional runner. Today's guest is Steph Bruce. Steph is a professional runner for Tracksmith, mom of three, co-founder of Picky Bars, and founder of Grit Running. Steph ran in college at UC Santa Barbara, where she was a D1 All-American. She went on to run professionally and is a three-time U.S. title holder, twice in the 10K and once in the half marathon. She's a two-time member of Team USA for World Cross. She's a seven-time U.S. Champs qualifier on the track and has competed in over 30 U.S. championships, including road championships. Steph has finished top 10 at New York twice and at Chicago, as well as London. She's run 20 marathons and has an average marathon time of 2:31. I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Steph Bruce. Stephanie, hi, welcome to the Fueling Forward podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have you here. You have just been a dominant force in women's running for so long, and I'm just so excited to share your story with listeners.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yes. So let's get started with how you got into running. Tell us a little bit about your origin story, how you found the sport, and what that looked like for you in the early days.
Yeah, I guess if I could go early, it was like probably middle school, grade school, when a lot of people, I think programs have this. It was like your presidential fitness award.
Yeah.
Where you had to do like the sit and reach, the mile shuttle run. And there was such a correlation. If you were good at the mile shuttle run, you could not touch your toes. So
I was just going to ask if you were good at that, because was not.
No. And it shows like distance runners, like we're not supposed to be that flexible. But the shuttle run sort of like, I don't know, it just got me like excited, because I think it was the first time athletically where I could beat boys. And I was finding that like, that was really fun to be competitive. And I grew up with three older brothers, so I probably always had a little bit of like a chip on my shoulder, like wanting to like stay in touch with them or just try to keep up with them. And yeah, then like naturally I got into high school, and I remember when we had PE in high school, we had like the 40 meter dash, and I didn't think anything of it. And I just ran as hard as I could. And the cross country coach at the time, like had all of our times, and he didn't like tell us, but I remember him coming up to me after, and he's like, "Are you interested in running cross country?" And I was like, "What's cross country?" And he's like, "Well, we run anywhere from like 2 to 3 miles on like random different courses, like on the canal, on dirt." And I was like, that sounds really boring. I really was like, I don't see the point. That was my flat out just like gut reaction. And he was like, all right, well, just give it a chance. So I was like, okay. So I did cross country like my freshman year. And then of course, like when track season came around, I was like, okay, this feels more like natural to me. But of course, as a high schooler, I was like, I'm a 400 meter runner. I think I even started in the 100 and 200. And I was like, oh yeah. Like, I think I ran something like 13 high, like in the hundreds.
Wow, so that's really fast.
That's what I think. Like, I mean, obviously it was hand time, so I don't know how accurate that was. But I remember being like, okay, like I think like this is what I do. Of course, I was dead wrong about that. And then honestly, as my high school career went on, my high school coach was just always like pushing, but in a good way. He was like, I think you have potential. Like if you just could show up to practice and be on time. And that was like a tough concept for me, because we lived in Phoenix. It was really hot there. So that meant practice was at 6 a.m. You know, and here I am, I'm a 15, 16 year old high school kid who I was like, I just want to sleep in. So I missed a lot of practices. I was late a ton. But he just kind of saw something in me, and he's like, Stephanie, like, just like, please keep giving it a chance. And I would say I incrementally got better, like each year, just very slowly and gradually. I think my freshman year, I ran like 5:55 in the mile. And so he was like, all right, like, you know, we got this. But I just didn't have like the love for it. I was just like doing it to do it, kind of. And then honestly, junior year progressed really well. And then senior year, that's kind of when like a little more of like life was happening outside of running. My dad had been diagnosed with prostate cancer about 6 years prior, and we were living in Phoenix at the time, and he was getting cancer treatment in New York, and his health was just starting to decline. So right before my track season, I flew out to New York to visit him, and I was staying with a family friend, and I got in on a Friday, and then I was going to go take the train into Manhattan and see my dad on Saturday. And I went for a run that morning, and I just remember having like the strangest feeling on that run, something to this day like I can't describe. And when I got back from the run, my stepmom was on the phone, and she said, Stephanie, your dad passed away. Wow. And I was like, no, you know, I'm like, I'm going to get on a train like to go visit him right now. And she's like, no, he passed away in the last hour. And I think what I realized at that moment was that feeling that I had. I think that he, I don't know, I wasn't a spiritual person, but I think he passed through me, like his spirit, because he died while I was on that run. And for like an 18-year-old kid, that was like this pivotal moment in my life where I was like, okay, you have two different choices. Your life could go this way, or it could go downhill real quickly, you know, depending on how I deal with this. And I was fortunate that, you know, my mom and my best friends and boyfriend at the time, they all flew out to New York because we were having the funeral out there. But when I look back, like, I was actually alone. I didn't have any of my friends or any of my family with me when I got that news. And I looked at that as a blessing, because I said, listen, you're probably not going to face anything harder than like losing a parent when you were totally by yourself. And I think that prepared me for anything that like was going to be thrown my way in life. So I got back and started my track season, and I was like, you know what, Stephanie, why don't you just see if running is like this gift? It's something that you get to do and not something you have to do. And I just took off that track season. It was like this cliche spiritual, whatever you call it. I ended up taking my mile time down from junior year. I ran 5:28. And by the time I finished my track season, I ran 4:58 in the mile and got second in the Arizona State meet. That's amazing. My journey. Yeah.
That's an incredible story. I got goosebumps the whole time that you were telling that. And that's so crazy, like that feeling that you can't explain that you said, you know, is your dad kind of speaking to you on runs. I'm curious if after that experience, did you feel like running was a way to be close to your dad after that happened?
You know, it kind of was like, it's funny now, like being an adult and having kids myself, like I see what happened to me so differently now, where I only knew how to deal with it as an 18-year-old, 19-year-old. I was very, I didn't see like the good signs. I went back and forth between like, why did this happen? Like, I don't have a parent now. But the way I looked at it with running, I was like, okay, he's sort of just always there. And if he couldn't see all the races when he was alive, like now he gets to see all of them. So I think I took that perspective for sure. But then on the converse, like I had my mom who was like my number one fan, and she was like, came to as many races as she could and was always like on the sidelines, like yelling, cheering for me. She had no knowledge of like running and what it meant. She just had this little like cheat sheet where she would like write down what times I ran and then like be like, oh, like that was a PR, you know, try to pretend like she knew what was going on. And that was just so like cool to have that experience. So yeah, I guess I got the best of both worlds, like having him always be able to see, but then actually be able to experience like all those running moments with my mom.
Wow, that's amazing. That's such an incredible and mature perspective from an 18-year-old that's been through so much.
I mean, I look back now and yes, it was. And I think it sort of, it made me grow up really quickly, because I did my fair share of partying in high school, and I feel like then I got to that moment and I was like, whoa, like you, like we have no idea how long we have in this life, and like I don't want to waste any opportunity. And then I also had three older brothers who dealt with it very differently. Like the four of us dealt with it, and I saw sadly like one of my brothers go the complete opposite way, and he has never recovered from like going into drugs and alcohol. And I was like, and we were all, it just shows like you're all in the same family, but circumstances and life events affect children so differently, regardless of like what house you grew up in. So it's given me like a really good perspective on parenting, and sometimes like parents feeling bad if they messed up with kids. And I'm like, it's a crapshoot because you just don't know, you know, how someone is going to, take on something that happens to them. And they were all older than me, so you would think they were in better capacity, but it was almost like I hadn't shaped my opinion of life yet. So I was really open to just being like, okay, I can say, oh, poor me, why is this happening? Or I can say, what are you going to do about it?
Wow, that's incredible. And I think that also speaks to what running gives people. Sports in general, I think for youth especially, is so important. It provides this kind of second family, this source of accountability to take care of yourself and make good choices. And, you know, it's interesting, like you had running to focus on and you had this kind of channel and outlet. And I think that's something I see a lot of young athletes turn to sports as a coping mechanism. And and I think it can be just such a healthy outlet for people. Of course, it can be taken too far sometimes, but I think it does give us that support and structure that we really need when we're young.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So with all of that going on at home, I'm curious, from a nutrition standpoint, what was your relationship with food like growing up? What was kind of mealtime environment like in your family?
Yeah, I've had this question one other time, and I remember like thinking about it. It's like it sounds weird. It's like an easy answer for me because it just came really natural in my family. I don't know if that was having three older brothers, but like, it's almost like food wasn't even discussed very much. It was just like, here's breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Here are our snacks. We all pretty much ate the same things. It was taught like, eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full. So when I like, again, zoom out now as an adult, I'm like, wow, like I kind of got really lucky with how my family was, because that is not the case. And same thing with sports, like my cross country coach at Xavier, Dave Ansicle, I mean, he coached for 30 plus years, and bless his heart, he just was probably the best influence I could have imagined, you know, having as a male coach, because again, food wasn't talked about. It was just like, we're doing the training. And yes, I think we might've talked about recovery, but I mean, this was like 1998, 1999. It was like, just drink Gatorade, and we were having power bars. And probably the only thing that he like would say when we got more serious and we were like actually going after big goals, like we were trying to break the state record in the 4x800. So there were four of us that like all trained together. And his best advice was just like, Stephanie, maybe just like Chick-fil-A like two times a week and not five, you know? And I feel like that was so healthy. It wasn't like, don't eat fast food. He was like, could you? And I mean, that was good advice. I definitely did not need to eat Chick-fil-A five times a week, or we would get out of school and we would go to McDonald's and get like fries and a little cone like most days. So when I look back, I just, food was just like fun. You just ate it when you wanted. And I think because we exercise, like whatever body we had was just like, yeah, that's just the body you have, you know? But again, I look back, because I'm now surrounded by the whole world that I went through, I think that has just allowed me to have such a healthy relationship with food, with body image. And I learned from a really young age, aside from like trying to help yourself recover, like people are going to be better than you and worse than you and have a different body than you. People could be heavier than you and they're going to beat you. People could be lighter than you and they're going to beat you, you know? So there was never any like one way was how you ran fast. It was just like put in the hard work, like believe in yourself, be mentally tough. And yeah, so I got really lucky, I would say, growing up.
That's amazing. And I had such a similar experience. Like, that's kind of how we talked about food in my family. It's just food. And I got so lucky with the coach I had in high school. Same thing. He's a male coach and never talked about food or body image or anything. Same thing. Like, maybe don't have a huge Chipotle burrito right before practice, but otherwise, like, you know, fuel yourself. And I feel like, you know, I've talked about this a lot in the podcast. That is a rare experience for a lot of athletes, but I think it creates this protection Because the sport undoubtedly has challenges when it comes to body image and fueling. So you ran in college, you ran at UCSB. What was that transition like for you? Did that change the way you viewed food or body image at all? Or were you, did you feel like that kind of stayed the same for you?
You know, it was fairly similar, I think, because again, then my college coach, Pete Dolan, what was so great about him is like, he was the most vocal about like eating disorders and body image. And so this was the first time where he was like, are you getting your period? Like my college coach is flat out, was like asking women. And I think that kind of helped me be like, yeah, like this should be a normal conversation and this should not be like off limits and taboo, where it's so difficult now, right? Because sometimes you'll hear like, oh, you can't talk about that with, but as an athlete, like that's a huge staple of like your performance. And then there's, it's more nuanced than that. But yeah, so to me, I remember like being like, yeah, like I do get my period regularly. And I would say when I got to college, I had the normal, like my dad had just died. I would say I probably gained like the freshman 15, and that was just being in the dorms, like access to food, probably like comfort. But then I remember when I got home, like that summer before my sophomore year, I was like, Mom, like I think this is kind of like not natural weight for me I put on. And she just helped me in like small little ways where she was like, well, like you're still running, but all it means is like you need to have a little bit of deficit if you want to lose a little weight. And yeah, she just kind of taught me about like different forms of protein. And then that summer I ended up just running more miles. I think I went from like 50s to like 70 over the course of the summer. And there was one period where it was the only time in my career I lost my period. And that to me was like, I started Googling things, and that's where like female athlete triad came up. And I was like, okay, I think that means like calories in and calories out were not matched up. And so the fact that I lost my period, my body was probably saying that was too fast. But then I honestly, it only took a few more months and I was able to just get it right back. And then from whatever that date was, sophomore year of college, knock on wood, I had never missed a period outside of having my children. Yeah, so it just, it taught me a lot. And then I think what my college coach taught me, because he was so vocal, I started to understand how looks were one thing and then people's behavior was another. Because when I came back and I was getting super fit, he saw that I was lean and he actually said to me like, do you have, he asked me if I had a problem. And I was like, Pete, no, like I'm just like getting super fit. And I think what he kind of was like calling me out. But what he and I learned, like I was always going to have a really lean frame because I don't necessarily have a muscular build. But at the time I had a teammate who, if you looked at us, she looked bigger than me. And then I knew that she was bulimic. And I'm like, how crazy is that? That like looks can tell someone one thing and you can think like, oh, she looks unhealthy. And then here I was knowing my poor teammate who looks softer than me. She actually was the one suffering with it. So it gave me like a really good perspective on like how many people are silently dealing with things, or you can't judge a book by its cover. So it's good to just have open and honest conversations about it.
Absolutely. Eating disorders, disordered eating, don't discriminate against body types, and anyone can be impacted. Looks do not reflect somebody's health. I try to remind athletes of this all the time. I think, you know, as runners, we tend to compare ourselves a lot to other people on the start line and, you know, thinking, oh, I need to look like this person to be fast. We don't know what that person's going through. We don't know what they're dealing with. They could be struggling with their relationship with food or their health, and we just don't know. And the only way to know is to focus on yourself and what you can do for yourself. And it sounds like you did a really good job of giving your body some time and space to change and not panicking when it shifted and being really smart and gradual. You know, not making any sudden shifts is so, so important for athletes to think about.
Thank you. Yeah, I think so. I think I was just, if you're going to do something and like put your, all your time and energy and your heart into it, like you have to be curious about the learning process. So on both ends, I was like, well, if I lost my period, why did that happen? Why do women lose their periods and how do I maintain it? And so that has been sort of a staple of my running career. And I think it shows I rarely get injured. I've had two stress fractures in my 15 plus year career. And I kind of knew what they were from. It was like too much speed and too much volume all at the same time. That's something that I'm really passionate about and have tried to talk to other women or hopefully like be guidance or mentor in that capacity.
Absolutely. And I think like the fact that you've maintained a period throughout this entire long career is also speaking volumes to protecting you from those injuries, because that's what I try to highlight to athletes is, you know, not having a period is of course concerning, but sometimes they tend to think like, oh, it's just because I'm fit. It's just where I am in the season. Mm-hmm. But the problem is it is taking away from your performance, from your health, and you can't always see it until it's too late. Mm-hmm. And for somebody like yourself, having a consistent period, even though that seems like maybe just kind of a one-off fact, I think is a really big piece of why you've been able to stay so injury-free and only have two bone stress injuries over the course of a super long career.
Thank you. I agree with you. I think so too. And it's funny, as I got like older, you know, the having a menstrual cycle was like one thing, but then I was like, ooh, I also think like ovulating is also a bigger gold standard, because you can have your period and that's just the bleeding, but the ovulation basically is saying that your body, the brain and all the hormones are saying, hey, I can get pregnant, I can give birth. And essentially, I think what people don't realize is like the reason your period is shut off is like it actually goes back to the old days of when like women were hunters and gatherers and they were like, there's a famine, hold on, like we don't want this person to be able to bring life into the world because there's not enough food. I think the ovulation part is really key, and I try to tell people, I'm like, hey, like get an ovulation kit if you don't know what that is like. I get like the pain, so I kind of like know, but I think, yeah, having that is really important because it can just tell your body like you are fueling correctly, the hormones are all aligned, and also letting like people know doesn't have to be intentional. A lot of like people losing their periods or not ovulating, it's not that they're trying to have an eating disorder, but just not being mindful of like how much you're having and how much you are like refueling, even forgetting about snacks or forgetting about this. It's like, if you want to be doing this running thing, can't be forgetting about eating or forgetting about planning. It's just, you know, part of the job.
It really is. And that's such a good point that you raise about the anovulatory cycles where you are bleeding, but you're not ovulating. Mm-hmm. I feel like as women, we were not taught these things in health class. Like we weren't taught what it means to have a regular period or what phases look like or what to be looking for or even what a regular period is. And that is such a great point. You know, there are tools that can help you understand more about your cycle. I recently have been wearing like an Oura ring. I got one as part of this like research study I'm doing. And that's really cool because it tracks your basal body temperature to monitor if you're ovulating. And, you know, those are just things that most of us don't know unless we know to buy ovulation testing kits and things like that. So that's a really good point. And it sounds like you did an incredible job of educating yourself and kind of empowering yourself with that knowledge that a lot of female runners, I think, aren't fortunate enough to know. And that's kind of also why we're here, is to talk about those topics and help bring awareness to them. And again, I think that contributed to your long career. You had a really successful collegiate career. You became a D1 All-American. Tell us a little bit about your progression in college.
It was actually mirrored high school very much, because when I got to college, you know, I had run 4:58 in the mile, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be a miler. And then my college coach saw my stride, and he's like, okay, probably not. But I think like everyone gets to college and they think that. And so he slowly like built me up mileage wise and event wise. And then by my junior year, he was like, what about the 10,000? And I was like, that sounds just gross. So, you know, so long. But he's like, let's give it a go. I just have a good feeling. And I'm so glad he had me do it. I believe the school record at UCSB at the time was 33:55. And I was like, oh my gosh, like that's insane. Because my 5K PR at the time was 17:05. And then I ran at Stanford, and you know, Stanford is a magical track. And I ended up running, I think, I'm forgetting the tenths, but like 33:28 for my first one. And this is back in 2007 or 2006. no, 2005 maybe, when like that time was like in college, you were like, okay, like I'm in there.
We were running in moccasins, not super much. Shoes.
Yeah. I was running in sandals and Crocs. Yeah. And so that to me, like, he was just like, oh my gosh, like that's your event. And I was like, dang it. And especially like how I ran it too. I ran like some stupid 1643, 1642. I'm like, oh
wow.
My. Yeah. It was
such
like
a metronome.
So I kept shooting myself in the foot by these people. Yeah. And then, and then honestly, later that season, I went to run a 5K and totally blew up. And I was like, oh, that's weird. I almost ran as slow as like half of my 5K and the 10K. And they were like, hey, have you ever like done blood testing? And we had not done that at Santa Barbara. We were pretty old school. So I went to the health center. I did blood testing. And they were like, we're going to check your ferritin. And so this is the first time I'm hearing about red blood cells and all that. And so just ready. They checked my ferritin. It was 4.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, exactly.
That is low.
And I had no idea. And I remember they came out and they were like, how are you walking? Like, how are you alive? And I was like, what do you mean? And so that is started a little bit of my journey of my gut and trying to figure out like, okay, like what was happening. So I started taking this liquid iron and just like nothing, you know, was like changing. And then I took a little bit more of it, and then we're getting ready for NCAs. And I was like grinding through some workouts, and I was like, all right, well, we're going to just see. And so I kept on the iron for those next like 7 weeks. And I remember like going in, I'm like, okay, I think I'm feeling better. And the day before we left, I had another blood test, and we get my iron, and Pete, my coach, was like, we're not going to tell you what the iron is. He's like, cause I want you to just go run the race and not have that in your head. And I said, that's fine. And so NCAAs was in Sacramento, and it was like a super hot night. And I remember just being like, oh, this is a grind. Like, it felt so hard. And here I was, I had run 20 something. And I'm running like 81s, 82s. And I was like, oh, why is this so hard? But I'm in this pack, and I think I'm in a pack with women who are in 11th, 12th, and 13th. I was like, all right, you just got to stick here. And I remember Pete yelling at me with like a mile to go, like, you know, they're up ahead. And I was like, I'm just surviving here, buddy. And then we get to the bell lap, and he just was like, you just gotta go. And so I remember, I felt like my eyes were shut, and I just was like swimming as fast as I could. And he showed me a video before, and he said I passed 4 women in that last lap, and I ended up finishing 8th, which was the last All-American spot. I like fall on the ground, super dramatic, all this. And we were like, oh my gosh, this is huge. And I went up to him and I was like, oh my gosh, Pete, like we did it. And I was like, what was my ferritin? And he was like, 5.
Oh my gosh.
Right? So 2 things happened at that moment. I realized I was tougher than I thought. And then the other part was like, this has eluded me my whole career. We're like, what would I have run in college if I had figured that out? So it was kind of exciting to be like, wow, like this is where you go from here. So fast forward, we wouldn't figure this out till later, but basically we figured out I had gluten allergy, I'm a dairy, and some celiac sprue sensitivity. And that is essentially why I was taking iron but not absorbing anything, because no matter what, I was eating gluten and dairy and had no idea. But then I got things to like baseline. I don't know if we checked my iron, but things got a little better. And then the next year, my last year, I ended up getting 5th in the 10K. It was an awesome college career. When I got there, our team had never made nationals in cross country. And I said, I believe that we will go. And then by the time I was a senior, we had qualified for the first time. Wow. And then we finished 9th in the nation. My last year, which was awesome. And it just became this band of sisters that we had, which was really cool. I think we beat at pre-nats, I think we beat CU.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. It was like a cool like claim to fame because we had never been there. So that was really special. Yeah. And then I don't know, I was like really hopeful for my running career based on how college finished.
That's amazing. College was like my favorite time in my career. College running is so special, and it's just such a fun time and just such a unique environment. And that's amazing that you were able to, I just can't get over that you got eighth NCAAs with a ferritin of 5. That's just like insane. And I totally get that feeling of that like haunting of what if my ferritin had been normal, what could I have run? That's kind of why I went into nutrition. I'm like, I don't ever want athletes to be thinking what if. So addressing that is huge. And so you ended up figuring out that you had a lot of food allergies, which is really difficult sometimes for runners to navigate for the first time, because a lot of the foods we eat and rely on contain gluten and dairy. So what was that transition like for you, having to cut those foods out? How did you navigate that?
You know, the first time like that someone asked me, it was a naturopath, and they were like, have you like been familiar with food allergies? And this, again, this was 2007, 2008. I was like, no, like I haven't really heard gluten-free, all those things like hadn't really come out that publicly. And they were like, well, people can just react to the same foods. Like someone could be eating a bowl of pasta and you're eating that and your body's chemically react totally differently. So they were like, we're going to do an elimination diet where you take out, you know, these big triggers and then you bring them back in. And I remember taking them out and I was like, oh, I feel awful, because you have to take out like sugar, and it's just this most like simple, like I was eating, I think just like chicken, veggies. And when I say like sugar, like you can have ketchup, you can have mutts, things like that, where any additives. So I did it for a few days, and besides the like withdrawal feelings, then after I was like, oh no, I feel good. I felt better. And that was like really worrisome to me. And then it, sure enough, as soon as I brought back in gluten, I mean, I just felt, I felt like hungover. I had a headache. I just felt like I was in this brain fog. My face, like my weight, actually, I couldn't gain weight. So I was staying really lean, but my face was really puffy. And I was like, man, this is really like reacting. So to be honest, it wasn't that hard in the beginning because of how much better I felt. I think what I had to do over time was just do research, right? You have ingredients about foods you think you're eating and you're like, oh, soy sauce, that's actually gluten. So I did a lot of research in the beginning, and then I had like a small, narrow, like, okay, you can eat these foods. And then I feel like over the years, because of like the food industry and what was available, that became like wider, right? I could have gluten-free pancakes, gluten-free waffles, breads. But then I got a couple more allergies slowly over the years. I started reacting to things like xanthan gum. That's like a binder. So then I couldn't have any of the gluten-free flours. And then coconut and egg. So random little things kind of just, they just made it not fun. Like I couldn't really socially be like, hey, can we go here? So over the years, I just found my places that are good to go to. Eating at home is very easy. There's so many things I can have. Like my diet consists of white rice, brown rice, sweet potatoes, regular potatoes, gluten-free brown rice pasta. I eat all meats, red meat, chicken, turkey, salmon, all fruits and vegetables, nut butters. So there's like a lot I can eat. It seems crazy to people when they're like, what do you eat? And if I showed you like what we buy at home, it's super easy. Like I said, it's just not as like socially fun. Or like I just bring my own things to a lot of dinners we go to or potlucks. And then I found a chef out here who sort of helped like supplement a couple of things. Like I'm not good at baking, and I was like, I really have a sweet tooth. So she makes me these black bean brownies that like are peanut butter filled, and like it tastes just like a brownie to me. So there aren't too many things that I miss, especially because there are worse things you could have in life than food allergies.
And you felt better, which is, and your ferritin wasn't 5 anymore, which is, you know, the most important thing.
I think I've gotten it up to 80 at one point.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it made a big difference for you. And speaking of things you could eat, Picky Bars is one thing. And you are a co-founder of the company Picky Bars. So I've always been curious, what is it like creating a food product, and how did that idea come to you?
Yeah, it's funny now because I still get interviewed about it, but like we sold the company a few years ago, so it's no longer like ours, but it's still like a amazing story. It was 2008, and I was injured. This is before I had figured out a lot of these allergies. I was living in Eugene. I had joined the Oregon Track Club for an interim and then ended up finding a different coach out there. Brad Hudson is actually who I started working with.
Oh, wow. Boulder connection.
Yeah, yep, exactly. It was myself, Dathan Ritzenheim, and Jason Hartmut. Wow. So we were coached by Brad there. But yeah, I was just struggling with a lot of injuries, and there was this apartment complex where a lot of the OTC athletes lived, and there was this like janky gym where they had like two exercise bikes. So I was like, all right, I'm just gonna cycle. So I'm on there, and then another woman comes in, and she's clearly a runner and she's injured, and she starts cycling, and we just start talking. And I, at the time, like, mind you, I had finished fifth at NCAAs, but I had run, you know, 33 mid, and like Kara Goucher, Shalane Flanagan, they had all made the Olympic team in the 2000, and they had run in 2008, 31:30, right? So I'm like 2 minutes away from that. So I'm telling this woman, I'm like, yeah, like I have dreams of like, you know, working my way to try to make an Olympic team one day. And she's so nice. She's listening. And then I was like, what about you? And she was like, oh yeah, like, I ran 14:58 in the 5K.
Okay.
Wow. I said, you actually like are there. And basically that was Lauren Fleshman. Wow. She had just run that, and then she got fourth at the trials, the worst spot, and she broke her foot. So here she is. And I'm like, I can't believe I just told this story about myself, you know? So now I'm asking her like what her career is like. And then we just start becoming friends, and she invited me over to her apartment. And she's like, hey, my husband, Jesse, he's trying to be a pro triathlete, but he's going to business school right now. And so I'm trying to make these like balls for him, because like when he, whatever he eats, she's like, he's so gassy, he farts all the time. She's like, and I can't handle it. So she's like, and I just feel like there's all these like power bars out there that like you can't pronounce the ingredients and they taste so bad. So she tells me she's throwing like dates and protein powder and dried fruit. And we honestly just start like mixing things with our hands. We're like swapping stories. We're laughing. And then we start rolling them up into little balls. And she was like, yeah, like I think this is kind of like what I want to do. And after a couple of weeks, we just Googled, how do you start a an energy bar company in your home? And it said, number one, get your kitchen certified. Number two, have a business plan. And so she's like, okay, like I can get the kitchen certified. And then she said, Jesse, can you write us a business plan? And he was like, oh my gosh, you guys, like what, this is, what is this? You know, he was very skeptical, which is good. You need to have like different personalities and strengths coming at this. And I was coaching like a community group at the time. And I was like, oh, like what if we made these bars like custom and people could tell us what they want in it? And then we sold it to them. And we were like, all right, what should we sell them for? And I was like, what about a dollar? And Jesse's like, awesome, you're going to make 11 cents a bar. We had no like financial intelligence about like overhead, because I think it cost us like 89 cents to make the bar. So we were not going to make a profit. But at the time, we wanted to like fill the gap and fill the need. Yeah. And then just over the next like year and a half, things kind of took off. Like Lauren looked more into the licensing. We looked into like how we could actually make them. Jesse built us a website, and the rest is history.
Amazing. That's such a fun story. And I love that it started just out of like filling a gap. I think that's something that, you know, that's why I started Fueling Forward. I feel like there was a gap in nutrition counseling for runners. And I love to hear when people just go for it. And I think that's something that a lot of people have great ideas and they're hesitant to do it because they feel like they don't know how to execute it, or they don't feel like they have any business doing it. But sometimes you have to just go for it and ask questions later and figure it out along the way, which it sounds like you guys did, which is so fun.
We did. And you know why I think like people don't do it, like in my opinion, especially as pro runners, because other people aren't doing it. And you're like, oh, it looks cooler just to be a pro runner and do nothing. Mm-hmm. And not knocking people who do that. And if you think like that's the path to success, like just laying around all day and playing Nintendo, like that's what my 11-year-olds do. But I don't think a 27-year-old person needs to do that. And so I have always believed, like, if you can find something that you can have as a passion while you're a pro runner, when you retire, you will not feel like you're starting at square one and being like, okay, I'm 36 or whatever, now what? And so I think our hope was like starting that company when we were injured allowed us, we both got back to sport in a big way. Like Lauren ended up coming back and winning USA's on the track in the 5,000 2 years later. And then I had like one of my best 10 years of my career after. So it kind of just shows like we wanted other people to be like, how can you live an awesome life pursuing this professional sports, but also having something else that not necessarily was like, this is what we'll do. Like I probably won't ever start another food energy bar, but it taught me so much about like the balance and the hustle and entrepreneurship. And I just wish more like pro runners would be open to that and being like, oh, okay, like what is my strength? And don't be afraid if your fellow pro runner is not doing that. Like you do it.
For sure. And I think that's like injuries really tend to force us to face the reality of like, what is my life outside of running? And yeah. Having that life balance is something for me that was huge just in different times in my career. For me, it just helped take the pressure off of the results and helped me find self-worth and things to do outside of running, which was always very important to me. And for you, you did after college go on to run professionally. You still run professionally. So tell us what that transition was like into professional running for you. What did that look like out of college, and kind of walk us through that progression?
So when I first got out of college, I remember like groups had not quite started yet. It was very much like, I would say top three people like were getting individual contracts, but the whole group setting wasn't happening. And I remember actually a group was starting in Flagstaff. This was McMillan Elite, and he had like talked to me about it, and I was like, ooh, I don't know if like that's my thing. And I look back, which is funny, and I kind of said no. And so then I kind of, I would say got lost a little those next 2 years moving up to Eugene, trying to figure out what I was doing. I was injured. I like contemplated whether this was what I was supposed to do. And then I had met my boyfriend at the time at NCA's, and he ended up moving up to Eugene to be with me. But then when he moved there, a new coach joined OTC, and that was Mark Rowland. And that ended up being like the best fit for my, I'm saying boyfriend, it's spoilers, my husband. Because Mark Rowland was a British steeplechaser and Ben was a steeplechaser. And so what was ironic about that is like I was having a miserable time and he was having like an amazing progression and like his career was like taking off. And here I was being like, man, I am like stuck. I'm suffering. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I remember thinking like, should I go be a lawyer? I was like going to volunteer for hospice. There were all these different things I was going through. And then when I found the food allergies out, I remember emailing a bunch of coaches across the country. And I just said, hey, this is what I ran in college. I've been injured, but I really feel like I can be like one of like our top marathoners, would you take a chance at me? And of course, no one got back to me. But the coach that I had said no to, who started the group in Flagstaff, he got back to me and he goes, Stephanie, even though you said no 2 years ago, like I've still been following you and I 100% believe. So Ben and I said goodbye. He stayed in Eugene because things were going really well. I moved to Flagstaff. And after being here for 9 months, I ended up running Houston Marathon in 2011. And that was sort of breakthrough. I ran 2:29, 30 something, and took third. And I remember the coach just being like, you were right. Like you just bet on yourself and you believed it. And right now, if you look at 2:29, you're like, okay, like that's like not doing anything. But what was cool about the time, there had only been six women in that 4 year Olympic cycle that had run under 2:30. And wow. So it put me as like sixth ranked at the time. And I was like, okay, like this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And then, you know, things would merge and change and that group ended up dissolving. But then I met Ben Rosario 2 years later here. And then he and his wife, Jen, were starting a group. And they were like, we really have this vision of what pro running in a group should look like. And then that was kind of like the next best 10 years of my life being with NAZ Elite. And it was awesome. And I had some of my best days, best times with my teammates. Memory that will be forever imprinted on my heart, and just an awesome career. And then we stayed here, and then I've since given birth to 3 children since moving here. So now a family of 5, and been in Flagstaff for 15 years.
Amazing. That transition to the marathon, that's an incredible time. I mean, especially like we talked about before, the shoe technology too. You guys have to remember that. Like, shoe technology makes a huge difference. And we were talking right before we started recording, and you've run 20 marathons. Your average marathon time is 2:31 over the course of 20 marathons. So you know a thing or two about marathons. So when it comes to fueling during the marathon, what have you learned there? What's your approach that you find works well for you?
I'm going to be the worst advice giver on this, because even over the 20 like careers or marathon career, I have a strategy, but it has never been the same. I think because I've had like different gut issues, and I look back at that Houston race and I'm like, I don't even know. I'm sure I took like a few power gels and then some Gatorade, and I just had no problems. Like, things went down easily. I don't even remember counting. We put a bunch on the bottles. I probably put like 4 to 5. And I can honestly tell you, I don't remember what I took, but I remember, like, I remember the days before feeling really like heavy on runs. And I was like, I think that means I'm like carbohydrate loading really well. Cause like, you know, when you have carbohydrates, then your body pulls water to your cells. And I was like, I think that heavy feeling was just like being super fueled well. So if from an early time, I kind of believe that, yes, what you take in the race is important, but it's how you're fueled in that training cycle and pre-race. So I think I was on the start line in a good position. And then that kind of just like went up and down throughout my next couple marathons. And when I used to be able to take Gatorade, then I started to like throw up Gatorade in races. So then I was like, man, is my gut changing? And I tried like all the new gels. To this day, I still can't tell you like what sits well, because I tried Martin gels at some of my races, and then they didn't work, or the in training they didn't work. And then at the Olympic trials in Atlanta, I had 3.5 gels and they were great. They stayed down. Yeah. So I'm sort of the worst when it comes to this advice. I know the principles. Like, I know at like a top level, at the upper limit, like athletes are aiming from 80 to 100 grams of carbs per hour. That would be ideal. I don't think I've ever gotten that much. That's amazing if your stomach can tolerate it. So for me, that would be having like 3 to 4 gels an hour. I would definitely throw that up, or have a bathroom break. So that'd be 7 to 8 gels over the course of the marathon. But some people have iron stomachs and they can do that. So I think with the marathon and your own career, it's trial and error. It's figuring out like what sits best, how you can pre-fuel, and what you can get away with in the race. And I would say if you're looking at your performances and everything else, you're healthy, training's gone well, and you're still just not having the day that you think, look at your fuel and look at like where could you get more. And I think that is something that over time has now been emphasized a little more. Like, carbohydrates are awesome, and they're much needed fuel source. The most you can handle in races, honestly, the better off you're going to be. So I'm aiming to work my gut up too, but it just has not worked as of recently. So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the takeaway there is you're fueling. You're trying to find the fuel that's going to work for you. And it looks different every time, and that's okay, but you are practicing it. You're trial and erroring it. That's really what you have to do. And I love that you highlighted the fueling leading into the race is important. Like you said, like, it's, yes, the day of the race, of course, is important, but that's not the only thing you should be thinking about. The fuel in the weeks leading up to the race itself, that's really where you you feel the most ready for the race on the start line. And I also love that you brought up you felt a little bit heavier the week before the race. People tell me this all the time. They're like, I feel terrible in my taper week, or I feel terrible in the days leading into the marathon. And a lot of the times it's because you're well fueled and you're rested and you're ready to go. It's not a bad thing if you don't feel great leading up to the start of the race. In fact, it might mean that your glycogen stores are nice and full and you're hydrated and you're ready to go.
Yes. I feel like that's really good advice for athletes to hear that.
Yes, that's such a great point. And you have had now 3 kids while you've been a marathoner. So something I'm always interested about is just hearing more about your experience with training through pregnancy, coming back to training postpartum. I'm sure that's looked different for you from kid to kid, but tell us a little bit about maybe some things that you've learned along the way with running throughout pregnancy and postpartum.
I have learned that it's so individual, woman to woman, athlete to athlete, pregnancy to pregnancy, you know, because I'm like, for example, I raced just last weekend alongside Amy Davis Green, and she's 14 weeks pregnant. Like, she's put that out there. She's killing it. And I don't think she realizes it, because I'm like, oh, when I was 14 weeks pregnant, I was just getting off the couch because I had such bad morning sickness. You know, and then I train through most of my pregnancies pretty similar, probably from like 12 to 13 weeks till about 30. And then my belly was so big, that I had like pelvic pain and round ligament. And as soon as I had any ounce of pain, I was like, that means my running is done. That was like pretty easy for me. And then you have women, like a good friend of mine, Rachel Smith, for her first baby, I think she ran up to like 39 weeks. Carrie Goucher ran like the day she gave birth to Colt. So it's just so individual. So I had people be like, oh, could you like write a pregnancy book? I don't even know how it would do, because it's so individual. And I think, but people still do ask me advice, but I think it's just listen to your body. It sort of will tell you. I don't think you can run too hard during pregnancy, because I think, again, your body has its own governor. At least that's my experience. Like, I was so motivated as a pro athlete. And then when I was pregnant, I was like, yeah, like, I feel like running hard today. And some days I'm like, I'm going to be on the couch today. So I really think like you are your own good governor of like how hard or how easy you should train. And then whether what you do during the pregnancy makes any difference after, also a crapshoot. Like, I don't know. I know women, like I stopped at 30 weeks. And then, like I said, Rachel stopped at 38. And then we came back like similar times. She ran a little, you know, before I did. But again, it's all about how your body changed, like how much excess like weight and skin I had in my belly. That made it harder to run. It got a little harder postpartum after each kid, but then I knew more, so I knew what not to do. And I knew like, okay, you might have a little bit of discomfort, see how you feel the next day, and that usually is a guide of like you did too much or you can progress a little more.
Yes, for sure. Listening to your body, that should be every runner's guiding compass for every phase of running. It's always important to listen to your body. It knows what it's talking about. It's not trying to trick you into quote unquote being lazy. No runners are lazy. Like, taking days off is okay. Backing off is okay. All really great advice. And speaking of body shifting, one of the things I would say you went viral for lack of a better term, was talking a little bit about experiencing diastasis recti and having some of the, like you said, looser skin around your stomach. And that was something you've been really vocal about. So is there any words of wisdom or anything you can speak to when it comes to those body shifts, how you've navigated those, and words of advice for other women going through a similar thing?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky when I did a lot of research, like to be like, okay, who helps with this? So I found like one of my best friends, the pelvic floor specialist, Sarah Tanza, and then Celeste Goodson. She owns a company that she started called ReCore, and that was basically like retraining your core. And I don't know if I found her, how it worked, but she was just so great at being able to be like, all right, like, let's assess where your gap is. So if you have DR, basically your abs have separated and you have space. And then her whole goal, and it became mine, was like, not what you look like, but what you can do. And I think that's a huge parallel to just in general, like how you should look at training. It's not like how does your body look getting ready for this 10K? It's like, what can your body do for you? And so I think with like DR, it was always a matter of function over like aesthetics. So I still had a 2-finger gap a few years after having my boys, but I was having no pelvic pain. I was healthy. My hips, obliques, glutes, everything was really strong. So it's never too late. Also, I know women who are 7 years postpartum and they're like, yeah, I'm still having back pain. Like, it's never too late, because if you basically can work inward to outward, meaning you need to get the intrinsic muscles of your abs to turn on. And once those do that, then it makes everything from the exterior like get stronger. And that's how you can do more core work, more aggressive ab exercises.
Amazing. Yeah. So another instance of where looks don't reflect everything and appearance is not what's important. Like you said, what your body can do is what's important, and that's going to look different from person to person. So I really appreciate women like you sharing your story and being vulnerable about it. It's something that so many women experience. And I think pregnancy and postpartum generally is kind of an isolating experience because people don't talk about it a lot. They're not putting it out there. And so just the more stories we can tell like that, you know, the more women we can help. So thank you for being open about that. And you just recently had your daughter, and now you're running professionally for Tracksmith, which is amazing. So what does the future look like for you right now with running?
So future right now, it's this really good, I think we're calling it like, someone's using this for an article, like second starting line. And that's kind of what it feels like, where, you know, when I joined with Tracksmith, primarily my still job is pro runner, athlete, races, results, training, but also having a little bit of this, like, I'm part of the sports marketing team, and I'm learning kind of how the company works, and then being in charge of like our athlete support program. We have some other programs coming down the line that we're announcing soon, which is exciting. And yeah, just honestly getting to do the things that I've been so passionate about my entire career, that like now I'm doing that. Like, I get to be the fun person who is sending shoe orders and sending like race kits, and then tracking results. And yeah, just being excited for like our up and coming athletes, helping people get to their start lines, helping people who are getting ready to qualify for USAs or qualify for the trials, and more just building other, like building the brand of Tracksmith, building like the stories of others versus like telling my own. It's like I've been telling my own story for so long, and I'm still going to do that. But my hope is to sort of use all the experience that I've had to like try to elevate other people now and elevate the sport. And yeah, just leave a imprint that you can do it your own way, the healthy way. Your timeline doesn't have to follow other people's, and you should be enjoying it. When it's not fun and it's full of anxiety or all this worry, like that's when you know like you shouldn't be doing this, because this job has always been a privilege and something that I'm really grateful for.
That's an amazing outlook. I love that you're giving back to the sport. And on a personal note, Tracksmith is who sponsored me to go to the trials. For people who aren't familiar, when you can qualify for the Olympic trials, you have to pay your own way. Going to Eugene is not cheap. Staying in Eugene is not cheap. So Tracksmith is actually a huge reason why I was able to achieve that lifelong goal. And I love that you're giving that opportunity to so many other runners. It's really meaningful work. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And stay tuned for some exciting news coming down soon.
Yay. We can't wait to hear it. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. Before we jump into our rapid fire fun questions, do you have any last kind of words of wisdom or piece of advice for any runners who are listening?
Yeah, I would just, here's something that's like always resonated kind of with my journey. If you're struggling or something is like not feeling right, there's always an answer. And so go find that answer and sort of just bet on yourself in whatever avenue that means to figure out what it is that's wrong. And whether that like path leads you to having to give up running or end your running journey, I just always believe there's an answer. And if you're willing to like put in the work to find that answer, I think you'll be really satisfied with, like I said, even if it's like, oh man, my best days are behind me, or I can't get out of this injury cycle, you'll really thank yourself for being like, but I'm going to like figure out what it is that's causing this and what those answers are. So just kind of bet on yourself.
I love that. Bet on yourself. And that's something that, you know, I've tried to do in my career, and it's, you know, just showing up for yourself and trusting yourself, listening to yourself, listening to your body. And you don't have to just accept things if you're miserable, if things don't feel right. You're not stuck. You always have the decision to change things and get out of that rut. So I love that advice and just such an inspiring story. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. We're going to end on a fun note with our rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
I am. I'm not great at these, but I'm going to try.
Honestly, I'm not either. Hopefully these are fairly easy for rapid fire. Okay. The first one is, what is your go-to pre-run snack?
So bad. Funny, it used to be Picky Bars, but I mean, because of my allergies, like, it's not fun. Like, a lot of times a bowl of rice, a white rice,
great,
like peanut butter and salt and coffee. And then I have this new almond milk creamer coffee, like French vanilla or caramel macchiato.
Awesome. Perfect. Bowl of rice. That's a great one. Easy carbs. Love it. what would you pick for your last meal? These aren't easy, are they? No,
that's good. Probably like my favorite, like French fries, a burger with no bun, and then bacon, avocado, and a Coca-Cola.
Yum. That sounds like a good one. What is your favorite dessert?
That I can eat or that I can't?
maybe that you can eat, that you can enjoy.
I mean, like I said, something that I have now because my allergies is this black bean brownie, and it's peanut butter filled. Like, it's really rich, and I have that, which is a cup of almond milk. But like, when I could eat dairy and gluten, I would say like any ice cream product, like Blizzards from Dairy Queen were my favorite. I can mess those up. Or Cold Stone Creamery. I don't know if people remember those. Where you get the mix-ins. That makes me sad because I can't have those.
Oh, yeah, that was my go-to in college. Yep. What is your least favorite food? And I would say, allergies aside.
Ooh, least favorite food. I don't know if I have a least favorite.
That's okay.
I know. I'm trying to think of something that I'm like, I do not like. I think because of my allergies, there's not many foods that I don't like. So I don't have one.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. No dislikes. That's a first for sure. if you could travel anywhere in the world for a food experience, where would you go?
I mean, if I was not allergic to gluten, I would probably go to Italy, and get, or France, get baguettes and croissants, pizza and pasta, but I can't eat any of those. So I feel like, when I went to South Africa, we went there for a honeymoon. That was actually really, they were really friendly with like gluten and dairy free. They have, what they're known for is their English breakfasts there, or obviously the UK. And those are my favorite. Those are black beans, fried mushrooms, tomatoes, hash brown potatoes, and sausages. They were the best. Yeah, we had those every day on our honeymoon.
That's a unique combination. I haven't heard of that before.
Yeah. Oh, and did I say beans?
No. Like, oh yeah, the black beans. Yeah.
Not black beans. What are like the fun like canned beans? Like when you think of like going to a barbecue, like bush beans.
Oh, like the baked beans.
Baked beans. Yes.
Yeah. Yum. Yeah. That sounds so like a little very sweetness.
Good. Oh yeah, it was very good.
So, interesting.
Yeah, English breakfast.
Mm-hmm. English breakfast from South Africa. All right. Nice. I love that.
Or in the UK, obviously.
Or the UK. Yeah. what is your go-to lazy meal?
Beef tacos. Mm-hmm. We'll just fry up corn tortillas, put seasoned ground beef, usually like white rice, avocado, black beans, and
awesome. Easy one.
Three nights a week.
So good. And kids love it. Yeah. And then the last one, what is your favorite coffee or tea drink?
Ooh, iced mocha with almond milk.
Yum. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Steph, for being on the Fueling Forward podcast. Where can people find you if they want to keep up with you and look out for that Tracksmith announcement?
Can find me in Flagstaff. and then I on my social media, it's actually both of them are my maiden name. Instagram is at Steph Rothstein, and then Twitter at Steph Rothstein as well. And then I have a website, stephbruce.com, and that should be it.
Amazing. And you have a camp coming up this summer.
I do, yeah. Adult Running Camp, Bruce Camp, at the end of July.
That sounds like so much fun. So check that out if you're interested in summer camp. Thank you again for being here, and we will be on the lookout for things to come from you in the future.
Thanks so much. I love chatting with you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode with Steph Bruce. You can follow her on Instagram or Twitter at Steph Rothstein, and you can also learn more about her adult running camp at stephbruce.com. Next week will be a Q&A with me, your host, so if you'd like to submit a question to be answered on air, you can do so on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or you can email me at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you at the next Fueling Forward Friday.